Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, September 1st, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Dillon Fire Update, Friends of the Eel River celebrates 30-year anniversary, and rescheduling marijuana and its potential effects on research and industry. So stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
An update on the Dillon Fire in Klamath County. It is currently at 6,346 acres and is 7% contained. There are approximately 827 personnel on scene. KMUD News spoke with Jason Eagle, Public Information Officer for the Dillon Fire, for more information on the incident.
Well, we have firefighters who are really focusing today in the southern part of the fire, around the Rock Creek area. That's the area that we're working to try to establish the line in to hold the fire. Southern portion, that's one of the big focuses for today. And then they're also going to be focusing on the structures in the communities up to the north that where the fire had northeast of the fire where it had crossed the Klamath to the east side of the Klamath a couple of days ago. Still doing great. A lot of structure protection area. That's actually, if you look at the maps, you'll see that's where they actually obtained some of the containment in that area around structures to try to protect those that area. So that's been really successful and it's looking really good in that area. And up to the north, there are a couple of areas where the fire spotted outside across the river. And those areas are active and have potential for growth. Good move to the north. And we're seeing, we are seeing with this current weather, conditions are getting drier. It's a little bit hotter and drier for the next 2 days. And the weather is also set up where we can see a larger fire growth with smoke. We look here in the column where the actual fire can get a lot more air and start to grow more. And there's going to be a slight increase in winds, too, that we may see that would also impact it and could result in a fire going. Tomorrow is actually the day that really see that fire has a great potential to get active. So the priorities are focusing on those areas where the structures are. It's an area that's across the river and the that's around there, and also to the south has been a big focus in the area near Rock Creek. They're also in the northern end, the fire is also checking up in a green Dillon Creek Grand. And this is fire's kind of back down into that. And then to the north, there's also this old fire scar up to the north that it's kind of buffered in, but the fire does have potential to kind of go around it and move up to the northwest at some point. So there is a chance for the fire to grow. We could see that. So that they're having to prioritize, like I said, anywhere near structures and things as the fire is potential, especially these days when the weather is getting hotter and drier the next couple of days.
With additional resources mobilizing in the area, Highway 96 will see increased traffic. Along Highway 96, there will be limited one-way traffic control from 10.7-mile marker west to 2.2 miles west of Cottage Grove due to fire operations. Drive with caution, as debris is rolling into the roadway and visibility remains low during early morning hours. There are currently evacuation orders and warnings in place. All structures in the T-bar have been placed at a 3-go status, Soma's Bar. There's also evacuation orders in zones SIS-1405, SIS-1402-A, SIS-1503-A, SIS-1509-B, and SIS-1506. The latest evacuation information can be found at protect.genesys.com. That's protect.genasys.com. For updates on the Dillon Fire, you can contact 2025.dillon@firenet.gov on email or visit the Siskiyou County Office of Emergency Services Facebook page, facebook.com/SiskiyouCountyOES. KMO News will continue to bring updates on fires during the 2025 fire season. Friends of the Eel River is celebrating its 30-year anniversary, coinciding with the removal of the Potter Valley Dams, which the nonprofit has fought for since it was formed. Sigurd Bjorn has more.
Friends of the Eel River is a non-profit formed by a group of Eel River enthusiasts to advocate for the river and its fish. This coming Saturday, the organization celebrates its 30-year anniversary at the Eel River Lodge in Fortuna. We spoke to Executive Director Alicia Hammond about the event and some of the nonprofit's past accomplishments.
Friends of the Eel River has been passionately advocating for the recovery of the wild and scenic Eel River for 30 years now. So we are having a big kind of once in a decade celebration to mark this momentous occasion. We are hosting a banquet style event at the Fortuna River Lodge on Saturday, September 6th from 5 to 8 p.m. It's going to include a catered dinner with live music by the Ponies of Harmony. We'll have a special VIP speaker, a presentation on our latest work and our ambitions for the future. One really fun thing I'm excited about is we're going to have a rousing game of Eel River Jeopardy. Contestants include some local elected officials and folks who are somewhat experts on Eel River trivia. Marissa McGrew from the Natural Resources Department of the Wiat Tribe is going to be hosting that game for us. We'll also have an amazing silent auction where you can score pack raft or other outdoor gear, jewelry, artwork, lots of other stuff for a really great deal. So if you're looking to, you know, support a good cause and also stock up on some gifts for the holidays or some nice things for yourself, that's a great place to do that. We'll have a photo booth with all kinds of fun stuff. Props so you and your friends can make it a memorable evening and a couple other fun surprises. So it really is an event not to be missed.
During the past three decades, the organization has seen many highs and lows when it comes to the river and its ecosystem. When she's asked about their major accomplishments along the way, Hammond mentions a victory at the California Supreme Court against the North Coast Railroad Authority, requiring the agency to comply with the California Environmental Quality Act and ensure that tribal consultation and broad community and stakeholder input take place on projects in the Eel River corridor.
We also, just a few years ago, had litigation with Humboldt County that we settled, which resulted in a grant fund that sent about $1.5 million into the community for sediment reduction projects. Sediment in the Eel River is a really big issue. And so we were really pleased to do what we could to reduce the impacts of sediment and ensure that dirt stays on the landscape and not in the river. We also successfully listed the Northern California summer steelhead as endangered under the California Endangered Species Act. Summer steelhead in the Eel River are a really, really special run of fish. They are unique because they come into the watershed earlier than the other salmonids, and they kind of get a head start, and they're able to get farther up into the watershed than their winter counterparts. And so then they're able to bring those ocean-derived nutrients that our forests need much farther up into the landscape than the other salmon and steelhead are. And then, of course, we have also been leading the fight to ensure that the Eel River dams are removed for probably 20 years, we have been educating the public and policymakers about the real serious dam safety issues that are present at the project. Friends of the Eel River was formed largely to ensure that the Eel River dams will be removed. And that moment is quickly becoming a reality. So this is a really exciting time to reflect on all of our past accomplishments, just celebrating with our longtime supporters and allies, many of whom have been with us since the very beginning. We're going to have all of our current staff there, most of our current board members, and many of our former board members. So it'll be a chance for folks who have been supporting us from the sidelines to really get to know our organization on a personal level.
During this interview, we also spoke to Hammond about the upcoming removal of the Powder Valley dams, what the best case scenario for the Friends of the Eel River would be, and what could potentially stand in the way of that scenario becoming a reality. That part of the interview will air at a later date, but in the meantime, here is Alicia Hammond again, reminding us how we can get our hands on tickets for Saturday's 5 p.m. event at the Eel River Lodge in Fortuna.
Tickets are $60 And they're available through our website, eelriver.org, or you can definitely call our office at 707-798-6345 if you have any trouble finding where to purchase tickets.
Reporting for KMUT, I'm Sigurd Bjørn.
As of this month, the Trump administration has been considering the possibility of reclassifying marijuana from a Schedule I substance to a Schedule III substance. Under the Controlled Substances Act, which was passed in 1971, this means that marijuana would go from being a substance deemed to have no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse, to being considered to have a lower potential for abuse and more accepted medical use. KMUT News spoke with Dr. Whitney Ogle, an associate professor of kinesiology at the School of Applied Health at Cal Poly Humboldt, and also one of the co-directors of the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research, HIIMR, for more information on what the Controlled Substance Act is and how it works.
So the whole scheduling program kind of started in the 1970s, where there were drugs that were put under different levels of guidance in terms of how, if they have any kind of medical benefit to them or and how harmful they are to people. And so there's Schedule 1 through, I think, 5, but the ones that we talk about most are Schedule 1 through 3. Cannabis has been a Schedule 1 drug for since the creation of this program, and that means that is the most harsh, which means it has no medical benefit and has high likelihood of addiction. So to give you an idea, there's other drugs that are actually very harmful to people and have high likelihood of addiction that are Schedule II drugs. So more recently, in the past couple of years, they took CBD out of that list and made it Schedule III. And so right now, THC is technically still a Schedule I drug, according to the federal government. And what that means functionally is that to be able to do research, there's this whole long process to be able to get any product that you can give to human subjects. There's a whole long process that basically makes it impossible for us to show that there's any medical benefit or less risk of harm to participants in the way that they want us to do things. Actually, right now, it would be easier for me to do research on the impact of like mushrooms and on people than it would be for just smoking weed, which I see as kind of problematic.
With how marijuana is scheduled now, it is more expensive and difficult for researchers to study it. Not only are there loopholes that researchers have to jump through with different institutions, but there are also less funding opportunities available. Ogle elaborates on how this affects her work.
What it means for me, so my research is about how people use cannabis with exercise. And so if I wanted to do research on people and to see how consuming cannabis might impact their performance on, you know, a number of different factors. There's all these different loopholes. It's probably going to be just this year that I'm going to be able to do research where I can have people under the influence. I cannot have people under the influence on campus. The university cannot take any funding from anyone, any company that makes at least 50% of its sales from the sale of cannabis. And so so it means that there's less funding opportunities available for research. And it really makes the process of doing research so much harder. We have to find all the little loopholes. So I'd love to be able to investigate these things that people are talking about, you know, casually on podcasts, and actually see if there's any research to back up what people are talking about. I think that a lot of people actually don't know that cannabis is really highly regulated in the research world. And so there seems to be a lot more, you know, if you walk into a dispensary and the bud tender tells you, oh, this product is really good for this thing, this thing, this thing. I just know that there's no research to support that in human subjects. And so I think it would make it, it would be really beneficial for us to have research that backs up some of the claims of different products that are available to the public and just make it make a more educated cannabis consumption community.
Whether or not this hypothetical rescheduling occurs, As nothing has been set in stone as of now, other than the fact that the administration is considering it, some would argue that rescheduling would affect the state of marijuana research only slightly. KMA News spoke with Dr. Dominic Korva, co-director of HIIMR, about what is misunderstood about the issue.
The thing that's misunderstood about this issue is that it doesn't really bear a direct relationship on the legal weed market, the state's legal weed markets. It doesn't mean federal legal weed. It doesn't really indicate any particular change necessarily at anything going on at the state level. The main thing Schedule 3 does is make weed available for research without having to go through like a major DEA license and review. So basically, you know how the federal government had a federal research farm in Mississippi, University of Mississippi, since 1976, and distributed medical weed through it. They didn't do a ton of medical research or anything else like that, that you might expect. And then about 6-7 years ago, the DEA kind of opened up the process so that like other entities could actually get research licenses, but nobody's been able to monetize those since then. Like there were 8 companies that like went ahead and got that. So it's totally unclear what the actual effect is going to be on, say, cannabis medicinal product. The fact that like you can do it now isn't new, right? Like it was possible before, even though it was Schedule 1. The key thing would be it makes it much less expensive to do so, which, is pretty important. But, just because something can be researched doesn't mean that suddenly, like, there's going to be some sort of green rush in cannabis research. Obviously, like, pharmaceutical companies are, they stand to benefit from it, but they've stood to benefit from it for a while. I mean, since GW Pharmaceutical, 20 years ago. And the fact is, like, they haven't. And it's really strange and interesting. So it is a big deal in that it means that the federal government then recognizes, cannabis has medicinal value. It does deviate from the global treaties, which may mean that there may be some global treaties, but let's face it, global treaties don't mean anything anymore. Who cares what the UN has decided is okay or not at this point? So the first thing I would caution is like this is the outcome of a long-term political process that is a bureaucratic change. It definitely does not enable recreational cannabis to be sold across state lines or globally. It doesn't even pave the way for that, but it does mean that actually universities, for example, could participate in research a lot in an easier fashion, and private entities, usually pharmaceutical companies or bioscience companies. But you have to have money to do research. People don't really, universities aren't sitting around with a bunch of extra resources waiting for something to drop in their lap, and then like people with free time jump on it. They're doing other things. They've got other agendas. They've got other kinds of funding, and there would really need to be a funding apparatus for doing the work to make it useful, for it to have a big effect. There are sides out there, right, that are claiming that, this is the, incrementalism that will move us forward. But I think that at this point in time, we shouldn't be so naive as to think that we are, in fact, headed in any kind of progressive direction around weed, around anything. It's all marketing at this point. So, like, my big caution would be, who uses this to market their stuff, really? And who uses this to basically do the next pump and dump on, some sort of financial play, pump up the value of companies, and then turns out they're worthless because they're actually not doing anything. So Schedule 3 is not a, it is a historic change, but, like, at this point, we have been through a lot of historic change in the last 15 years around weed, and it rarely seems to actually kind of move the ball on basic freedoms for like home grow and consumption and getting people out of prison, which should be the basic orientation, I think, of cannabis politics at all. I'm generally cynical about the state of the world as it is, so take it for that. But I would be cautious about people getting super worked up one way or the other about what the effect would be. It's kind of a wait and see.
As of now, the policy of marijuana being a Schedule 1 substance is still in place. Though on Friday, August 29th, Democratic New York Representative Jared Nadler reintroduced the Marijuana Opportunity, Reinvestment, and Expungement Act, MORE, which seeks to federally legalize cannabis by descheduling it altogether. For more information about what HIIMR does, the website is humboldt.edu/HIIMR. In national news, U.S. revokes visas of Palestinian officials ahead of next month's high-level UN General Assembly meeting. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The United Nations General Assembly will convene for a high-level meeting at its New York headquarters next month, and that's when several countries have announced they'll recognize the state of Palestine. But the U.S. State Department has thrown a spanner in the works with the announcement that it will revoke or deny visas of some Palestinian officials, namely those from the Palestinian Authority and the Palestine Liberation Organization. Details were not clear when Palestinian UN Ambassador Riyad Mansour was asked about the move during his news conference on the war in Gaza.
This statement attributed to the State Department was just released. It was brought to my attention just about half an hour ago. We will see exactly what it means and how it applies to any of our delegation, and we will respond accordingly.
Under the agreement to host the United Nations in New York, the U.S. is not supposed to deny visas for officials going to the General Assembly. But the State Department says it's complying with that by allowing the Palestinian diplomatic mission to attend. It was not immediately clear if Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas would be affected by the new move. Ambassador Mansour says President Abbas was leading the delegation to next month's UN meetings, and he was expected to address the General Assembly, as he has done for many years. During a news conference by the UN Secretary General's spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric, one reporter asked whether denying a visa to President Abbas violates the UN headquarters agreement.
We are going to discuss this with the State Department. I mean, the headquarters agreement deserves to be read, notably, I think, sections 11 and 12. We obviously hope that this will be resolved. It is important that all member states, permanent observers, be able to be represented, especially, I think, in this case, with the, as we know, the upcoming two-state solution meeting that that France and Saudi Arabia will host at the beginning of the GA.
In a written statement, the State Department said Secretary of State Marco Rubio is denying and revoking the visas because, it says, the Palestinian Authority and the PLO support terrorism and undermine the prospects for peace. It also called on the Palestinian Authority to end what the State Department calls its efforts to secure the unilateral recognition of a conjectural Palestinian state. Israel's foreign minister posted a social media statement thanking the Trump administration for this bold step and for standing by Israel once again. UN spokesperson Dujarric says he hopes this issue will be resolved quickly.
Obviously, we would like to see all diplomats and delegates who are entitled to come here to be able to travel freely.
Whether or not President Abbas and others are able to attend, the General Assembly meeting is bound to be dramatic. Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, and France are set to recognize a Palestinian state at the meeting. In any event, this is not the first time the Trump administration has used visa restrictions to target Palestinians. The State Department has also suspended a program that had allowed injured Palestinian children from Gaza to come to the U.S. for medical treatment. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Summer is prime time for gathering and baking camas across the Pacific Northwest, Rockies, and Plains regions. Native people usually harvest, then bake, the plant's bulbs as part of their first foods menu. As Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports, there was even a bake-off held outside Eugene, Oregon.
Salette's tribal member Joe Scott heads the Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program under the Long Tom Watershed Council. He described how he'd layer his packets of leaf-wrapped camas bulbs.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to throw the wet sword ferns on top of this. Bunch of water, like a couple of buckets of water, after the maple leaves. And then a layer of these skunk cabbage leaves, put the packets on top of that. And then the alder and the ferns and all this stuff right here.
Oh, and there's mugwort, hazel, and bracken ferns in Scott's recipe, too. The whole oven hissed with steam once the water hit the hot rocks. Nearby, the TEIP senior intern and my kid, Samuel Bull of the Nez Perce tribe, assembled the second oven with mom's help. This was mostly ferns, maple leaves, and camas bundled in skunk cabbage leaves, with some carrots and potatoes thrown in for experimentation's sake. all under canvas in four buckets of water.
Yes, I would put the canvas closer to the middle. Okay. Those yeah. Right there is great.
Is it cooking?
Yeah. Let's start to see.
Flash forward to a day later. Bola decided to do a canvas bake for 24 hours. The group peeled back the canvas to reveal glistening and translucent canvas bulbs.
Looks good.
Oh, look at those beauties.
Good?
It's really good.
Give me some flavor notes.
Really soft, sweet, and starchy.
Perfect. I'm so happy.
Wow.
And yes, Bowl's potatoes and carrots came out well too. Scott's batch baked for nearly 26 hours and had a small fire burning atop his oven for part of that time. At first, there was a little concern as some bulbs were hardened and dark, but then when the rest were unearthed...
They're perfect.
Wow.
They're like a sweet gumdrop.
The longer bake meant Scott's camas were more caramelized and sweeter, but at the end of the day, Scott said the real success of the event was creating community. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull, near Eugene, Oregon.
A new food spot is now open at the Albuquerque, New Mexico airport, featuring native foods. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
First opening its doors in 1976, the restaurant was reimagined in 2020.
Every Pueblo has a different style of what they cook, what they make.
Chef Josh Aragon is from the Laguna Pueblo and heads the kitchen at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center on tribal land in the heart of Albuquerque.
It's just a combination of all the Pueblos put together, all 19, as a matter of fact. And what comes out of the food is the smiles, the thoughts, the full bellies.
From fry bread and enchiladas to daily hand-baked goods like Pueblo pies, tortillas, and lots of loaves of bread.
Yesterday I did 3 batches, so about 104. Plus 240 dough balls.
Rita Toledo is the head baker and now has to prepare even more fresh dishes to feed hungry customers at Albuquerque International Sunport.
The bread we bake, somebody's going to take somewhere out of state. That's exciting.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Sigurd Bjorn, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KEMA News is online, and you can find us at KEMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kema.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KEMA, I'm Matt Cardos.